This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Those people that turned over and burned the cars on Granville, it's also an example of thwarted promise. Those are people that have cars, and they have homes, and they have money, and they're not happy. And they've been promised and promised and promised that having all that will make them happy, and it's a lie, and there's a lot of that going on.
Studies show humans rate driving and commuting as the worst and most stressful time of every day. They're not aware of the harmful fumes filling the car or the carbon pouring up into the atmosphere. As times get hotter, we just crank up the air conditioning, burn more fuel. Most people will work until mid-April just to pay their car costs when you add it all up. That's just their personal share. More is paid by all levels of government to keep the road network going. The auto, insurance, construction, and oil gang dominate our lives and our world. And it's a violent world of hurtling steel and graveyards. Everyone in my immediate family has been either hit by a car or in a serious car accident. My cat was run over dead. My dog was hit but lived. My son was run over but lived. The toll in lives lost, injuries, and people ruined is beyond any military action anywhere in the world. The car means war in our neighborhoods. Build those 8-foot fences for the backyard, people, the little jails where it is safe to let your kids and pets out. One day it snowed, unusual for our city. The street was blocked off. Suddenly, like moles entering the light, all the neighbors and the kids poured out into the street. They tobogganed and they frolicked where the cars could not hit them. People met for the first time. We didn't even need that street. Everyone had laneways and back with garages. The street should be ripped up and made into food growing and a play park. Give us room to live. Give us back life on a human scale. Kill the car. You are about to hear a fine speech on the true cost of car culture. Yves Engler launched his book June 27th in Vancouver. The title, Stop Signs, Cars and Capitalism on the Road to Economic, Social, and Ecological Decay. The African co-author is Bianca Mugiani. The two tried a road trip by public transit through the wild suburbs of America. It was savage territory, but Yves will tell you all about that and about your own life in this recording for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
David Cadman, Vancouver City Councillor, is going to start this off by introducing Yves in his book. Thank you very much.
Hi. I got this email from Yves saying, I've written a new book. Would you like to review it? Would you like to read it? And I said, yeah, sure. I didn't know what it was about at that time. And lo and behold, it arrived in the mail. And it's this book here, his fifth book, by the way, Stop Signs, Cars, Capitalism on the Road to Economic, Social, and Ecological Decay. And I read it, and I literally couldn't put it down. It just encapsulated so many things for me about the reality of our urban context, where the car dominates. I want to recommend it to all of you, of course, but I also want to sort of point out that he's written, as I mentioned, a number of other books, including, and I've got my copies of these now so I can hold them up, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, which Naomi Klein reviews very positively. The latest one before this one, another one called Canada and Israel Building Apartheid, and two others out there which I already had but which I didn't get another copy of, Playing Left Wing and Canada and Haiti. And they're all published by Fernwood Publishing. And I found this book in particular basically to take a road trip and turn it into a book on the car that brings out all the facts about the way in which our cities are designed for the car and the way in which shaped by the car and the extent to which we all pay for so much for the car. I thought it was just great. And I thought the aspect of it for me that was particularly interesting was sort of their trip. And I should say that he wrote this with Bianca Mogheni, who's a Ugandan, and their sort of exploration of arriving in a town and trying to get around by public transit. and literally being in certain places in the United States totally isolated. They just could not move. And I thought, well, aren't we lucky in Vancouver? And then I sort of thought about that for a minute, and I thought, no, once you go outside downtown Vancouver, Vancouver proper, the ability to move around without a car diminishes, particularly early morning, late evenings. And, of course, my daughter-in-law has spent the last little while in Victoria, and it was impossible to move around there. So it's maybe downtown urban areas in Canada were better, but beyond that, we've got a long way to go to get the kind of public transit that they have, for instance, in Germany, where you get off a flight and get on a train and get on a tram, and you never, ever have to have a car. And that's a good thing. So anyway, Eve, over to you. Let's...
First of all, thanks a lot, David. And thanks to the Council Canadians for organizing this, and Stop Pave, and to my mom, who did a lot of the organizing. So basically, this is a book, Stop Signs, Cars and Capitalism on the Road to Economic, Social and Ecological Decay. I've been on about 6 weeks of a book tour across North America. Bianca Maggeni, the co-author, was involved in the first 15 days of the tour. She has a day job back in Montreal, so she had to return. I do not have a day job, so you just have me here. And basically what this book is a critique of a transportation system structured around the private automobile. We're not calling for the electric car or some sort of car light. We're talking about moving completely beyond the private automobile and the social relations that the private automobile bring about. And the book is based around a two-month trip that Bianca and myself took across the prime habitat of the automobile, the United States. Canada, of course, is the second most car-dominated place in the world. So we're doing a little bit better, but not a whole lot. The book is divided into three sections. The first section is 17 chapters critiquing different elements of the private automobile. The second part, why the car has risen to dominance. And the final part, how do we move beyond the private automobile? It comes out of partly Bianca seeing the rise of the automobile in Uganda and East Africa, reading about the rise of the automobile in China, seeing the situation in Montreal and learning about ecological issues and the automobile in general, and then coming across a statistic that said there are 1.02 vehicles for every person of driving age in the U.S. So there are more cars than there are drivers. Which, you know, got us thinking, this is a pretty profound statistic. Are people, you know, towing a backup vehicle? Is that what's going on? And so we basically said we wanted to see what the car had wrought in its most prime habitat. But we, not having licenses, not having vehicle, living in downtown Montreal, where we got around basically entirely by foot, by bike, we could access what we needed, the food, the entertainment, work, etc. We could access all that by foot, by bike, and on occasion mass transit. We wanted to see what it was like in a landscape where that may not have been the case. And so we basically set off on a journey across the U.S. carless. We've got Greyhound passes. The goal was to try to cross the U.S. car-free. We were immediately thwarted in our bid to cross the U.S. car-free. We arrived, one of the first places we went to was in Fort Lauderdale. Bianca's friend lived in Davie, which is on the outskirts of Fort Lauderdale. We arrived at about 10 p.m. at the Greyhound station in Fort Lauderdale, asked if we could take a bus to Bianca's friend's place. They said public transit is done for the day. Asked if we could walk. They said it would take about a day and a night to get there. And we had to hop in a taxi. And $40 later, $40 that we didn't really have and didn't really want to spend, we arrived at Bianca's friend's place. The next day, we were like, we're going to put this, you know, negative experience behind us. We're going to take the bus to the local commercial area, and we're going to try to walk back. The sidewalks were more like nature trails. There was a torrent of traffic Just crossing the highway or the roadway was a real struggle. People looked at us like we were crazy for walking. The place was flat as a chapati, beautiful weather, no one on their bicycle. And this, of course, you know, contradicts a lot of what we hear in Canada, you know, maybe less in Vancouver, but on the East Coast, we hear that, you know, we can't bike, we have to have automobiles because it's so cold in the winter, right? But here's an example of beautiful weather, and yet even more car dominated. So what we experienced, and this was a common theme, and it's a theme, you know, throughout the Canadian landscape as well, is that we found that our freedom was really hindered in a car dominated landscape. Our ability to access things was really hindered. And this goes against some of the, you know, the automobile is really associated with the idea of freedom, right? The brilliant philosopher Ronald Reagan once said that the car is the last great freedom. The Wall Street Journal editorial said the automobile is one of the most liberating inventions of the 20th century alongside the microchip. So the car is really associated with this idea of freedom, but our experience in a car-dominant landscape is that it was actually a real hindrance, a real obstruction to our freedom. And so, and when you start thinking about this, a car-centric democracy really is a threat to a number of different groups' freedom. First of all, children. Right, who can't drive until the age of 16, totally dependent on their parents or friends to shuttle them from place to place. The elderly, right, who often lose their licenses, and geriatrics doctors talk about how one of the most difficult things they deal with in their practice is old people who are nervous they're going to lose their license. They understand that in a car-dominant landscape, that's going to massively increase their isolation. The disabled, who often can't operate a vehicle, and in the suburban fringe, large parking lots, no curb cuts, is very difficult to traverse. So in a car-dominant landscape, as much as a third of the population are excluded from full participation rights. But the question of freedom for drivers, there's no doubt that in a car-dominant landscape, there is a certain level of autonomy that's given with an automobile. But there's still a question mark there. First of all, growing congestion and commute times that, you know, people, some of the worst times of the day, lots of studies show how people's time commuting in traffic is some of the least pleasurable time of the day. But the main question for drivers and freedom is the question of cost. An amount of time people spend working to pay for their automobiles. It's about $8,400 a year to own and operate the average automobile. That's an incredible cost, which has prompted some groups to dub April 1st Auto Freedom Day. Right? You spend the first 3 months of the year working to pay for your vehicle to, you know, gas, insurance, car payments, whatever, and the last 9 months of the year working to pay for the necessities of life, you know, the food, the shelter, whatever. And if you compare the most car-dominated landscapes and the amount they work compared to less car-dominant areas, so for instance, Americans work about 400 hours a year more on average than people in the Netherlands. That, of course, is not entirely because of different transportation choices. That's probably mostly because of union power and different levels of union power in the two countries. But one of the reasons is because there is more of a focus on walking, biking, or mass transit in the Netherlands. If you calculate in the amount of time people spend working to pay for the automobile, the question of freedom for drivers is much more of a question mark. And the immense cost of the private automobile, of course, is not equal, right? It's lower paid that have a particularly burdened by the cost of owning and operating an automobile. One study showed that people, it's probably slightly less in Canada, but in the U.S., the people that made $15,000 a year spent on average 40% of their income paying for their vehicle. Incredible amount of money. And it's almost to a situation where people are working, you know, 40% of the time they're working is just to pay for the metal box that brings them to the workplace. But in the U.S., it's 88% of people who get to work with a car. In Canada, it's about 80% of the population that uses a car to get to work. So we're talking about the vast majority of people. And so if you need a car to access, you know, a great deal of the jobs out there, you know, it's not so irrational to be spending 40% of your income to be paying for that vehicle that helps you get to your job, as well as seeing your friends and other things.
Cars and capitalism, that's what's on the menu here at Cafe EcoShock. I'm Alex, I'll be your waiter tonight. Back to our recording at Simon Fraser University, downtown Vancouver, for author Yves Engler, Vancouver City Councillor David Cadman, and StopThePave.org's Carmen Mills.
And this question of cost and the way in which the automobile or transportation system structure around the automobile is regressive against the lower paid. And it gets thinking about how the way in which the car has stratified, further stratified society. The automobile begins early on, it's a plaything of the wealthy, right? Initially, it's not that technologically useful. The landscape is also not structured for the automobile, so it's not particularly practical to drive. It's just a way of sort of showing, hey, I got a lot of money and I can put a lot of money into this relatively useless technological toy. With time, the technology advances, the landscape becomes more structured for the automobile. But one of the things that the automobile has done is it provided a way for the wealthy to reassert their dominance over space and culturally. Prior to the rise of the automobile, the horse and buggy was the elite form, the form of transport that was, you know, quite exclusive form of transport. The horse and buggy was undermined by the trolley and, to a lesser extent, the train, or to a certain extent, the train. The trolley and the train, but the trolley was fairly available to all classes of society. And on trolleys, wealthy people were forced into a situation where they would have to intermix with those they saw as their social inferiors, right? Be it blue-collar workers, immigrants, black people, whatever. Those they saw as their social inferiors. And one of the things the automobile did was it provided a way to disassociate from having to interact with those you thought was a social inferior. And that continues until today, right? You see that with some of the stigma around the bus. Right, or as we mentioned in the book, a story about my dad and a coworker of my dad's who, you know, doesn't take the SkyTrain because he doesn't like the people that he you have to sit next to on the SkyTrain. So the automobile provided a way for the wealthy to disassociate themselves from those they deemed their social inferiors. So the automobile really further stratifies class divisions, but it also undermines the social movements necessary to tip back the scales between the rich and the poor, right? And that happens on a whole series of different levels. The landscape or the architecture of the automobile with a front garage, people drive right into their front garage, it reduces the amount of interaction you have with your neighbors, right? Which makes it less likely to be able to build some community organizational kind of power. There's a lot of studies that show the more people drive, the more right-wing their politics tend to be. The exurban fringes, people tend to be more likely to vote for our good friend Stephen Harper. The automobile undermines the social movements necessary in so many other ways. So, for instance, where do you hand out a leaflet in the exurban fringe? Right, the highway? Right, where do you put up a poster, 11 by 17 poster, in a car-dominated landscape? You can't see flying by at 30, 40, 50, whatever kilometers or miles an hour. You can't see 11 by 17 poster. That's really built for the pedestrian scale. The advertising in a car-dominated landscape is, you know, a big billboard, which how many grassroots groups have the money to pay for that type of billboard? Rebecca Solnit, in her book Wonderlust, she documents how car infrastructure or the landscape of the suburban exurban fringe privatizes space in a way that doesn't give, you know, the strip malls, we don't necessarily have the right to free speech, to organize, to there is a Canadian Supreme Court decision that does sort of challenge that. But to a large extent, our ability to leaflet or picket or to have political campaigns in the privatized space of the automobile is much less than in an urban area. And if you think of the Arab Revolution, you think of Tahrir Square in Cairo. What that was, I've never been to Cairo, but from what I understand, what that was the major square in central Cairo. And by controlling that square, that gives a whole bunch of political power, right? Well, what's the square that one would control in Phoenix that would give the political power to exert against the government? The landscape of the private automobile undermines the social movements necessary to tip back the scale between the rich and poor. The book goes into a whole series of other topics, and basically it's in the first 17 chapters, it's our travel experiences that are opening point for a political discussion about a certain topic. So being in El Paso, Texas, and being on a bus that goes over, on a highway that goes over a playground that's fenced in, and there's about six different roadway going to the side and above this playground where these kids are exerting themselves and sucking in all the pollutants of the private automobile. And just this example of societal neglect. Or another chapter of being in Atlanta, Georgia, and going to Martin Luther King's childhood neighborhood and seeing this highway that destroys the neighborhood. And in the U.S., dozens and dozens of black neighborhoods were destroyed by highway construction. And it's highways tend to go where the most marginal communities are. And I actually read that here in Vancouver, the viaduct, it was built through a Logan's Alley, which was one black neighborhood in Vancouver, and largely destroyed that community. And you know, similar process with Chinatown in Montreal. So it's the most marginalized communities that tend to have highways built through their neighborhoods. The book also goes into the way in which oil extraction, auto-centric development, is pushing oil extraction into more and more ecologically destructive areas. Obviously, the Alberta tar sands is one of the prime examples of just the ecological catastrophe that we're moving towards on that level. But we go into show, you know, what's going on in the Niger Delta, you know, in the Andean region of South America, the northern part of South America. And most importantly, it is simply unsustainable for individuals to jump into 2, 4, or 8,000-pound metal boxes to get around. That is simply unsustainable. And even if you could, when we talk about electric car, right, you know, in most of the North American landscape, what we're talking about is a coal or nuclear power fueled vehicle, right? Coal, of course, produces more carbon emissions, and nuclear power has assorted problems with it. But even if you can come up with a non-carbon emitting fuel source, just the production and destruction of the private automobile is incredibly energy intensive and emits huge amounts of pollutants. A 2007 study claimed that half the energy your car uses in its life cycle is in the production and destruction phases, prompting Norway to make it illegal for car companies to advertise as green, clean, or environmentally friendly without proving that was the case throughout the life cycle, from production to emissions to energy use to recycling. So it's simply unsustainable for people to get into these massive metal boxes to get around. What distinguishes this book from the other books about the private automobile, critical of the private automobile, books like Asphalt Nation, Divorce Your Car? One, I think we're more holistic in our critique of the private automobile. Two, the travel stories. I would like to believe that our travel stories are compelling. That's, of course, for you to decide. But politically, what really distinguishes this book is, I think, explaining the rise of the private automobile. This wasn't a democratic process where people were just clamoring for the private automobile, but rather it's risen to its position of dominance culturally, over space, transport, etc., because it has served the powerful, right? And there's a whole series of ways in which that's played out, most importantly that it has been the number one source of corporate profit for the past century. There's an ideological component to that. As I mentioned, the way in which it was a plaything of the wealthy and a way for the wealthy to assert their dominance over space and culture. There's another ideological component in terms of this individualism, this very antisocial individualism that the car tends to sort of bring about. And this, of course, this antisocial individualism is completely divorced from reality, right? The car is, in fact, a huge government interference into our lives. right? Most obviously with the publicly built roadway. Also, in terms of zoning regulations really come about with the private automobile, and zoning regulations are actually a huge infringement on private property relations. And also, through most of human history, people didn't walk 100 yards, stop, look up, and see if the sign, if it was, you know, yellow, red, or green, and decide if they could continue on. They just continued on if they could, and didn't if they couldn't. So the whole infrastructure, the car necessitates a whole infrastructure that, you know, is huge sort of government infrastructure. Nevertheless, the car tends to bring about this very antisocial individualism. But the real reason for the private automobile is that the auto industrial complex, the immense economic might of the auto industrial complex, they've used that economic might to influence all the institutions of society to advance their interests. We deal with that in the book, where we go into the way in which the car companies have used the school system to advance their interests, from elementary school to high school to academia. So, for instance, in 1926, Studebaker, which later becomes the, or which at one point was the largest automaker in the world, they financed the establishment of Harvard University's pioneering Erskine Bureau of Street Traffic Research. The head of this Bureau of Street Traffic Research becomes the leading authority in traffic research in North America, and he sees as his objective to convince city officials to improve the pathway of the private automobile. In the 1930s, the General Motors Institute, which is a GM-operated institute of higher learning, it is one of the few places that trains city planners. By chance, those city planners tend to see one of their objectives as improving the pathway for the private automobile. A couple years ago, the New York Times business section referred to Clemson University in South Carolina as, quote, BMW's custom-made university. McMaster University in Hamilton has a $60 million agreement with General Motors. In the cultural arena, there has been a ferocious propaganda assault by the automakers against the population. That might sound hyperbolic, but I think it's true. And the most obvious example of that is the $630 spent in advertising for each new vehicle sold every year. Automakers spend $630 in advertising for each vehicle they sell every year. They are by far the biggest advertisers, more than twice the next biggest industry. It's not just the official advertising. The automakers have been heavily involved in cultural production. By the end of World War II, GM had produced more than 50 films. Ford, Firestone had produced dozens more films that were all, in one way or another, designed to advance their interests. Many of the historians of the automobile have been financed by the automakers. Someone like Le Corbusier, the famous French architect, probably the most influential architect of the early part of the 1900s, some of his early designs were financed by French automakers.
You were listening to Yves Engler speaking in Vancouver, June 27th, 2011. His new book takes on the whole car culture. The title is Stop Signs, Cars and Capitalism on the Road to Economic, Social, and Ecological Decay. The co-author is Bianca Mugiani. Coming up, Yves describes how car advertising rules the media, including television news reporting. In fact, Engler says cars marry us to an authoritarian society. Stay tuned when Radio EcoShock returns.
All right, bravo. One more car destroyed.
Scientific evidence is mounting that cars are killing us in many ways. We know vehicle exhaust fills our lungs with toxic byproducts. These invade even in the womb, deforming DNA and setting up children for all kinds of childhood diseases, such as asthma and cancer, and possibly even autism. Our addiction to oil has fueled wars, terrorism, and unrest in far-flung corners of the world, and may be dictating a militarized society. The answer is simple, isn't it? We just need to get away from the oil-based car culture.